So our next speaker is Joan Gibbs, who is an attorney who works for the Center for Constitutional Right. She is an attorney working diligently on the case of Herman Ferguson, who Brother Ahmed mentioned, and working on the case of other political prisoners. So let us give Joan a round of applause.
Thank you. And revolutionary greetings of solidarity. I think for me personally, and probably for most of you, Malcolm's most important lesson, or one of his most important lessons, because clearly there was many, that it was essential for us to unite for our liberation. Now, Malcolm's call for us to unite is particularly important when we look at the question of repression, political repression. I'm going to limit my remarks here to the legal aspects of it. I want to note, though, at the outset that we have to understand that we have, since the time we got here, approximately, some say, in 1619, we have, since the very moment we got here, been subjected to repression. What has changed, really, is the way this repression is carried out, but we have continually been subject to repression. And the reason for that repression is very obvious, and that is, even at times when we haven't known it, the U.S. government and the government of various states and localities have always understood something, and that is that the Black Liberation Movement posed the most dangerous threat to its existence. And so they have taken means and acted measures throughout the history of this country to make sure that we did not succeed. So what we have to do, and Muhammad couldn't be righter, what we have to do is study this history, master this history, and then educate and organize and mobilize our people around taking actions to correct it and to bring them, make the government be held accountable. For example, I don't know if you saw this a couple of years ago. I thought it was a wonderful thing, but I thought it was very limited. Charlie Rangel, who I don't necessarily agree with, he rarely does anything very good, but one thing he did a couple years ago was he put forth in Congress a measure around Marcus Garvey to expose the fact that Marcus Garvey in fact had been set up and driven out of this country for the sole purpose of escorting his organization, because Marcus Garvey built the largest movement of African people that has ever been built in this country. And people don't like to say that, but that's true. And that's why Marcus Garvey ended out in Atlanta and thereafter deported back to Jamaica. So what we have to do, though, in this process is be able to openly discuss our differences. We can't ignore our differences. We shouldn't cast them aside. We have to be able to discuss them openly, because unquestionably they benefit both from our disunity and our failure to discuss our differences. Because how they have been able to repress this, and I think probably DeRuba is going to touch on this, is by exploiting the differences that exist among us. Somebody talked about the factionalism that was created, deliberately so, around within the Nation of Islam. Now, whatever we may think about the Nation of Islam, we do know that the Nation of Islam played a historic role in our movement, and most particularly the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. But the FBI destroyed that organization. Now, I want to talk about, having said that, I want to talk now, attention to the law as it exists today. Repression today is characterized by four essential components. The first, of course, Muhammad ever already talked about this, is surveillance and intelligence gathering. Because, of course, any government has to have a means of identifying those people who are his opponents. And so that's the purpose of surveillance and intelligence gathering. So in 1983, what the Reagan administration did was they enacted new FBI guidelines to make it easier for them to infiltrate groups and to carry out their surveillance. Now we have to be very attentive to that, because what has happened over the years, as technology has improved, is that their ability to penetrate our movement has definitely improved likewise. And so now they have the capacity. I recently read this report that was mentioned in the Times and then it disappeared, about a GAO report that had been done about the FBI. And I got the report from Washington. I read it, how they had been conducted all these hundreds of investigations based on nothing of people now. in the last 5 years, not, you know, 10, 15 years ago. The second aspect is that along with surveillance and intelligence gathering, they must have means of getting information out of even us. So they have to have a compulsory police questioning process and a way to intern us when we refuse to respond. And that process recently, although it has always been there, has been carried out through the grand jury, the federal grand jury most particularly. Because with your call to a federal grand jury, you have two choices. You can either cooperate or go to jail for the life of the grand jury, and that is up to 18 months. Then, after the issuance of the new guidelines, Congress helped out Reagan by giving another good tool for them. That's the 1984 Bail Reform Act, which allows the government to hold people in prison awaiting trial indefinitely if they are found to be a danger to the community or to be in risk of flight. And that's not very hard to demonstrate. I want to say, to go back to the grand jury for a moment and say and acknowledge the role that our brothers and sisters in the Puerto Rican Liberation Movement has played in educating us about this process, because it was that movement which was first subjected to the federal grand jury in 1936. The third thing that we have to deal with is special laws. Now, all throughout the history of this country, there's been various laws, there's been seditious conspiracy laws, but in the 80s, these laws are being used in a very, you know, been a very clearly and sharply political way. And then I say all throughout our history, because also Herman Ferguson and Muhammad was arrested on the state version of seditious conspiracy in their case in 1967. But the government has been using the seditious conspiracy laws to imprison and incarcerate people. And in the process, they just criminalize the whole activity itself. Now, if you buy this book over here that Ahmed, I'm sure it's going to tell you to buy. And the Puerto Ricans are in prison, a lot of them, because of seditious conspiracy laws. The next law is a law called the Racketeer Influence and Corrupt Organizations Act. Now, this law was originally passed because liberals are so fascinating. They have a way of passing laws, and they always say, you know, we're not going to use it against y'all. This is for the mob. So they passed this law originally to clear out the influence of organized crime in the labor movement. But very rapidly, very, very rapidly, it was turned on our movement. And that's why our brother, Matula Shakur, is now in jail for as many years as he is. The RICO Act, and its use, is an act that allows them to group within one case series of events and link them all together that have taken place over a 10-year period. And that is a powerful tool. If any of you were able to attend the Brinks trial, I think, because that showed how much of a threat to our movement this law really is. It really did show it, because you could see just among the defendants themselves how, you know, that law had been used to just link them all together and bring them all in there, and then, except for two of them, at the conclusion, imprisoned those defendants for periods of times that are just incredible. 60 years in prison, 58 years in prison, 53 years. Then too, the last decade has witnessed, and most particularly now is witnessing, an erosion of the rights of all criminal defendants, including and most particularly political activists. Here we have to note the use of anonymous trial juries. Now, one way you can really prejudice somebody against a defendant is to, at the outset, make clear that these people are so dangerous that they may even take actions against the jury. Now, the jury usually is a person's only hope. So once you do that, the trial and verdict is virtually over. Another new, and this is sort of a new development, really, and that is, and this was, I guess, expressed in its best form, probably in the Washington, D.C. conspiracy case, and that is the use of intense security measures around trials. Like if you, anybody here went to the Washington D.C. conspiracy case, any part of the proceedings in that case before it culminated with the pleas, the courtroom, there was a wall that separated the defendants from the audience, a plexiglass, definitely bulletproof wall. And even I went there once in the beginning on a hearing for Laura Whitehorn, even the lawyers were subjected to security procedures. And not without reason in the case of all some of us, but in the case of some of them, it was completely without reason. Two other final things I want to talk about, and that is the conditions of political prisoners and prisoners of war inside facilities. Some of you may have heard about the Lexington High Security Unit, which was built for women. That unit was closed down, and now one in its place has been built in Marianna, Florida, where people are being kept in conditions of, that are just horrendous. And then we have our brothers at Marion who have been in lockdown for years. And these are some of the issues that when we talk about political repression, we have to look at it throughout all its many aspects. And finally, and I hope we do have a chance to talk about this, and that is the federal and state governments gaining a wider access and control of our communities through their so-called war on drugs. And we have, you know, we have some in our community are even calling for different armed agencies, among them Major Owens in Brooklyn, who was calling to bring in the National Guard to assist the police because they could not get drugs out of Brownsville. So he called in and wanted to call in the National Guard. Now, we have to be very diligent in finding out about these things and discussing them, because it is true. And I live in Bed-Stuy, and I can tell you that, you know, I talk to, you know, various people, a lot of them, you know, not political activists. It is true that our brothers and sisters are really living in terror because of the things that are going on with these drug dealers. It is true that our, particularly our older brothers and sisters, don't even go out the house at night. And see, we can't no longer just talk about the fact that the police are occupying army in our community, although they certainly are. But we have to also be able to provide self-defense for our brothers and sisters, because in that way, we can really challenge the police and challenge them in the minds of our people. Because otherwise, I was in Washington recently, and there were roadblocks, and I was with a sister, Ayatollah. I was at her house, actually, this was a few months ago, and it was this roadblock getting where they had basically made the street one way instead of two ways, so they could like try to cut down on drug trafficking and just like conduct these random surveillances. So I talked to her about it, and she said, "Joan, let me tell you something." She said, "The police department would move these surveillance, would move these roadblocks, but the black community has demanded that they stay there." And so that issue we have to deal with, we have to address very soon, because otherwise, we're going to have, basically, we think we're under occupation. Now we are really going to be under occupation. Thank you.